I think you all know by now probably that the term of the trade for enemy territory and the jargon of all the services, but especially the Army and the Marines, is Indian country. It's when they say in country, they're abbreviating Indian country. So you hear Rachel Mandel, oh, in country, you're in country. They're saying enemy territory. Not to speak of all the war machinery that's named after, like trophies, Cherokee and Seminole and Black Hawks and all that.
That's Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz on Native America, from genocide to resistance. The centuries-long genocidal policies of the U.S. settler colonial regime has largely been omitted from history. The ferocity and savagery of the U.S. attack on Native Americans is usually turned on its head. The colonists were the victims. They had to defend themselves against the barbarous heathens. The sheer hatred for indigenous people manifested in genocide. George Washington called them beasts. Jefferson declared, "We will destroy them all." The notorious Indian killer Andrew Jackson said, "They must disappear." Jump to Barack Obama, who pronounced, "America was not born a colonial power." Really? Native Americans are still here. They have survived. The coalition of many nations resisting the Dakota Access Pipeline at Standing Rock was inspiring. Though the pipeline is being built, the resistance generated a consciousness and awareness about the situation of indigenous people and land and water issues. Our guest today is Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz. She grew up in rural Oklahoma, the daughter of a tenant farmer and part Indian mother. She's been active in the international indigenous movement for more than four decades and is known for her commitment to social justice issues. She's the award-winning author of An Indigenous People's History of the United States and All the Real Indians Died Off. She spoke at the International Socialist Organization's annual conference in Chicago. And now, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz on Native America, From Genocide to Resistance.
First, I want to pay tribute and honor the original peoples of this region, the Potawatomi, the Miami, Illinois, the Sauk, and to the great liberation leader, Black Hawk. So the violence of settler colonialism is revealed in what Anglo-American colonists called savage war. That's what they called it. They were savaging their prey. This is what is called more formally petite guerre or counterinsurgency in military annals and is theorized as the United States' first way of war by military historian John Grenier. This way of war in North America dates to the British colonial period and is described as a combination of unlimited war and irregular war, a military tradition that accepted, legitimized, celebrated, and encouraged attacks upon and the destruction of non-combatants, civilians, villages, and especially food and agricultural resources, in shockingly violent campaigns to achieve their goals of conquest and control. Now, the United States, I'll talk about the United States being exceptional toward the end. I think we should call the United States exceptional. But it's not exceptional in the sheer amount of violence or bloodshed when compared to other colonial conquests or even, you know, the Roman conquest before that, or the Christian Crusades that were backdrops to this world colonialism 500 years ago. So in Africa, Asia, the Caribbean, Mexico, South America, there was equally and sometimes worse violence and degradation. And in the settler colonial British colonizations of Canada, Australia, and New Zealand, which we think of as kind of benign vanilla places today, were equally genocidal, absolutely worse in Australia than the North American Atlantic colonies and later the United States. So eliminationism of a native is implicit in the project of settler colonialism, where land, not indigenous labor, is sought. In the rest of the hemisphere and outside of North America, the labor was sought. There was genocide, just as there was with Africans, but it was a genocide of overwork, exploitation, starvation, no kind of independence or self-reliance possible, which it had before. So extreme violence, particularly against non-combatants, was an aspect inherent in European overseas colonialism, always with genocidal possibilities and often with genocidal results. So what distinguishes the United States experience? Why is it exceptional? It's not the amount of violence or even the type of violence, except for its honing and development to the present. Rather, the triumphal mythology attached to that violence and celebrated, and its political uses even today. When history is translated into nationalistic and militaristic myth, as happened in the 1820s, in the Jacksonian era of the 19th century, the complexities of social and historical experience are simplified and compressed into representative individuals or heroes, and so-called revolutionary heroes. Richard Slotkin observes that from the first settlement in Jamestown, appropriating the land from its stewards became a racialized war, civilization against savagery. Quoting Slotkin, "Savage war was distinguished from civilized warfare in its lack of limitations or the extent of violence and of laws for its application. The doctrine of savage war depended on the belief that certain races are inherently disposed to cruel and atrocious violence. Similar assumptions had often operated in the wars of Christian crusading states against Muslims in Europe, North Africa, and the Levant, and massacres had often enough accompanied such wars. This way of war, largely devised and enacted by landed settlers, formed the basis for the founding ideology and colonialist military strategy of the independent United States. And this approach to war is still being practiced almost as a reflex, even in the 21st century, in the war on terror. In the 20th century, the United States carried out large-scale regular warfare alongside counterinsurgency in the Philippines, Puerto Rico, Korea, and Vietnam, as well as smaller-scale and prolonged invasions and occupations in the Philippines, Cuba, Nicaragua, Haiti, the Dominican Republic, and, of course, up to the present, Puerto Rico, as well as counterinsurgents in Colombia. So these counterinsurgencies of the United States carried on Colombia for 40 years, Southern Africa, most prominently in the 70s and 80s, of course, and decades still continuing in the Philippines and Afghanistan and more recently Iraq and Syria, among others. Counterinsurgency seeks to destroy the will of the people targeted collectively, not as individuals, but collectively, to break them up, or their capacity to resist collectively, employing any means necessary, but invariably falling back on attacking civilians and their support systems, especially food supplies and fields. The Anglo colonists in North America called it food fight. They named it food fight. Now called special operations or low-intensity conflict, and even blatantly, as in Iraq, revived counterinsurgency. This kind of warfare was used against indigenous communities by settler militias in the initial British colonies of Virginia and Massachusetts, and spread as other colonies were established, then legalized in the U.S. Constitution's Second Amendment, which mandated settlers' individual rights to take and hold indigenous lands, as well as to control enslaved Africans through slave patrols. Settler militias sought to disrupt it, every aspect of resistance, as well as to obtain intelligence through scouting and taking prisoners. They did so by destroying indigenous fields and villages and intimidating and slaughtering enemy non-combatant populations. These voluntary militias made up the individual civilians, called rangers initially, are what are referred to as militias, as they came to be called in the Second Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. And that did not mean National Guard, State National Guard. That meant these killer militias, rangers. During the period 1607 to 1814, the architecture of the U.S. military was forged, leading to its reproduction and development in the present. This formative period generated the problematic characteristics of the U.S. way of war, and thereby the characteristics of U.S. civilization, which few historians have come to terms with in manifestations of these tendencies in the post-World War II period that we are still in. Unfortunately, including socialist historians and theorists, including Howard Zinn. During the late 1600s, Anglo settlers in New England began the routine practice of scalp hunting and ranging. By that time, the non-indigenous population of the British colony in North America had increased sixfold to more than 150,000 European population, which meant that settlers were intruding on more and more of the indigenous homelands. Indigenous resistance followed in 1676-77 eliminationist warfare that the settlers called King Philip's War. The Wampanoag people and their indigenous allies attacked the settlers' isolated farms using methods that relied on speed and caution and striking and retreating, and of course possessing a perfect knowledge of the terrain. That is, resistance using guerrilla warfare. The settlers scorned that kind of resistance as skulking, they called it skulking, and responded by destroying indigenous villages and everyone in them who could not escape, burning their fields, homes, villages, and food storage. But as effective indigenous resistance continued, the commander of the Plymouth Militia, Benjamin Church, studied Wampanoag tactics in order to develop a more effective method of preemption or counterinsurgency. Attack first. He petitioned the colony's governor for permission to choose 60 or 70 settlers to serve as scouts, and he called them for what he termed wilderness warfare, although the indigenous communities were all farming and fishing villages. In July 1676, the first settler organized militia was the result. The Rangers' force was made up of 60 male settlers and 140 already conquered indigenous men. They were ordered to discover, pursue, fight, surprise, or subdue the enemy, in Church's words. The inclusion of indigenous fighters on the colonist side, later U.S. Army side, was not unique to British colonists in North America or to United States settlers. Rather, the practice has marked the character of European and Euro-American colonization and occupation of non-European peoples from the very beginning. The settler rangers could learn from their native aides, then discard them. Some of the indigenous communities allied with the settlers in their wars marked against their indigenous neighbors, which, you know, it gave rise to what historians focus on obsessively in this period as intertribal warfare. It wasn't intertribal warfare, which always turned out badly for any of them who did ally in that way when settlers turned on them. The Cherokees are a good example of that, who adopted slavery, who tried in every way to be the replica and succeeded. A class system, which had been before that a collective system. And yet they too were forcibly deported to Oklahoma, just like the Sauk and Fox and, you know, others who did not adopt those methods. So it didn't make any difference. It didn't change the status. It always turned out badly. It always does still. Think of the Kurds in Syria. When they ally with the United States, it is always the wrong thing to do. Not just morally, for their own sake. Increasingly, the varied native people formed confederations. In the following two decades, Church perfected his evolving method of annihilation, and these methods spread as more colonies were established. The native communities of New England continued to resist by bombing British settlements and killing and capturing settlers for ransom. As an incentive to recruit fighters, colonial authorities introduced a program of scalp hunting that became a permanent and long-lasting element of settler warfare against indigenous nations. During the Pequot War, Connecticut and Massachusetts colonial officials had offered bounties, as they did in the British and Scots settler colonialism and war to subdue the Irish over a couple of centuries. They had already introduced scalping and head taking, you know, cutting off the head, terrorizing by putting the heads along the road, and the people see their relatives' heads. So this was not new, but the bounties were new. At least I have never found any documentation on the bounties in Ireland. Maybe it existed there, but this was very thought out policy, which became a market. Scalps were capital. Scalps were a commodity. So initially it was heads of the murdered indigenous peoples, but you know, heads weigh a lot. And they're hard to carry around and get to the pay center or you pay for them. So they adopted scalps, which of course are more portable, but you really can't tell the age, sex, gender, anything from a scalp. So that really allowed a lot of slaughter of children. Scalp hunting became routine even outside of warfare and more profitable following an incident on the northern frontier of the Massachusetts colony. Anyone here from Boston? Uh-huh, so you may know this story. If you don't, you should, and you should go take down that statue. The scalp market began in earnest when settler Hannah Dustin, 1697, was taken hostage and murdered 10 of her Abnaki captors in a nighttime escape, presenting their 10 scalps to the Massachusetts General Assembly, which rewarded her with bounties for 2 men, 2 women, and 2 children. There were different prices for those, just like slavery. However, it was not until a century later, after U.S. independence, that the Dustin story was revived as a patriotic white nationalist narrative. Dustin's deed was celebrated as the first Anglo-American woman in North America to be cast as a heroic statue. Dustin has been famous for a few years, had been famous for a few years during her own lifetime, of course. She was a hero after her escape from captivity, and her bloody scalp trophies were highly publicized at the time, put on display. But she was pretty much forgotten until the 1820s, when stories about her began to appear in print and increased in numbers through the 1880s. Not just one, but 3 major monuments were erected in her honor. Lionized as a folk hero, Dustin's story was employed during the continuing bloody and genocidal wars against Native peoples that characterized settler and army violence to change it around as virtuous and defensive. She was attacked. She defended herself. So they're the victims. But what's really pernicious, and I think it then feeds into a whole history. I was one of the founders of the Women's Liberation Movement in the 60s, and I detected right away this thread of heroism of women, you know, that this, and her name even came up as, because I was in Boston, as an original feminist. So defensive and virtuous and even feminine, even feminist. All the statues still stand, unfortunately. Scalp hunting became a lucrative commercial practice from the early 18th century onward. The settler authorities had hit upon a way to encourage settlers to take off on their own or with a few others to gather scalps at random for the reward money. In the process, they established the large-scale privatization of war within Anglo-American frontier communities. During the nearly two decades of British colonization of the Atlantic shore of North America, generations of settlers gained experiences as Indian fighters, but also just civilians, you know, taking scalps off anyone just walking down the road for money. And this is all outside of any organized military institution. So when you read the so-called founding fathers not wanting standing armies and all, they were not talking about not having killer militias or slave patrols. They were talking about standing wars fighting in Europe. Anglo-French conflict may appear to have been the dominant factor of European colonization in North America during the 18th century, but while large regular armies fought over geopolitical goals in Europe, Anglo settlers in North America waged deadly irregular warfare against indigenous nations, and also against marooners, by the way, slave marooners. I'll get to some of that in a minute. Much of the fighting during the 8 years settlers' war for independence, especially in the Ohio Valley and the Great Lakes regions and western New York, was directed against indigenous resistors who realized it was not in their interest to have an even more empowered close enemy of Indian-hating settlers with their own independent government, as opposed to a remote one in Great Britain with wider global interests. So they allied with the British. Nor did the fledgling U.S. military in the 1790s carry out operations typical of the state-centered wars occurring in Europe at the time. Even following the founding of the professional U.S. Army in the 1810s, irregular warfare was the method of the U.S. conquest of the Ohio Valley, Great Lakes, Southeast, and Mississippi Valley regions, then west of the Mississippi to the Pacific, including taking half of Mexico, counterinsurgency all the way down into the Valley of Mexico, seizing Mexico City. Since that time, irregular methods have been used in tandem with operations of regular armed forces. The chief characteristic of irregular warfare is the extreme violence against civilians. Why do you think we have so many refugees in the Middle East right now? In this case, the tendency to seek the utter annihilation, pacification, or removal of the enemy population. In cases where a rough balance of power existed, as the situation in virtually every frontier war until the first decade of the 19th century, Anglo-American settlers were quick to turn to extravagant violence, just as you saw in Iraq. Most military historians ignore the Indian Wars from 1607 to 1890, as well as the 1846-1848 invasion and occupation of Mexico. But these wars formed the platform, the genealogy of officers, and mindset of the U.S. military actions in the United States Civil War and in the rest of the world. In his history of U.S. savage wars, counterinsurgent war enthusiast Max Boot does not even mention the Indian Wars as related to his thesis. The book is called The Savage Wars of Peace, Small Wars and the Rise of American Power. As military historian Grenier notes, historians normally dismiss backcountry settlers' burning of Indian villages and fields as a sideshow to the Army's attempt to mold itself into a force like those found in Europe. Yet the wars of the upper Ohio Valley and on the Tennessee and western Georgia frontiers are vitally important for understanding the evolution of America's military heritage. So I want to get to the Marines. Okay, so from the beginning of the U.S. was competitive in trade internationally and had free trade as a sacred quest, then as it is today. Take the famed U.S. Marine Corps, founded in 1775, a year before the Declaration of Independence and a year after the colonies formed the Continental Congress and Army. 13 years before the U.S. Constitution was ratified, forming the state, and 23 years before the Navy was founded. So this is the rock bottom, you know, militia founded. The following year, the Marines made their first landing, capturing an island in the Bahamas from the British, an island that remains today a U.S. colony. What in the Marine Corps history is called Fort Nassau, because that's the Virgin Island. In action throughout the Revolutionary War, the Marines were disbanded in 1783 and reorganized in 1794 as a branch of the U.S. Navy. But the character of a Marine is that of a colonial ranger created for counterinsurgency outside U.S. secured territory. The opening lyric of the Eternal Official Hymn of the U.S. Marine Corps, composed and adopted in 1847 in Mexico-occupied Mexico City soon after the invasion of Mexico, is halls from the halls of Montezuma and then to the shores of Tripoli. I don't know why people aren't more curious about this Marine hymn. Tripoli refers back nearly a half century to the so-called Barbary Wars of 1801-1805, when the newly formed Marines, or newly reconstituted Marines, were dispatched in 1801 to North Africa by President Thomas Jefferson to invade the Berber nation, carrying on this aggression, shelling the city, taking captives, and marauding for nearly 4 years in the North African coast. So ending with the 1805 Battle of Derna. It was there they earned the nickname Leathernecks for the high collars they wore as defense against the Berber saber cuts. Now this isn't deep hidden documentation. Go to the U.S. Marine Corps website. That's where I got all this information. This was the first Barbary War, the ostensible goal of which was to persuade Tripoli to release U.S. sailors held hostage and to end what the U.S. called pirate attacks on U.S. merchant ships. Actually, the Berbers were demanding that their sovereignty over their territorial waters be respected. The Berbers did not give up their demands. The Marines did not win, and they were withdrawn, returning a decade later in the so-called Second Barbary War, 1815 to 1816, which ended when the Pasha, Yusuf Karamanli, the governor of Tripoli, agreed not to exact fees from U.S. ships entering their territorial waters, the first military victory of overseas U.S. imperialism or gunboat diplomacy, as it came to be called, nearly a century later, when historians mark the beginning of U.S. overseas imperialism. The Marines and military history know better. In all their annals, that's the first great imperialist victory. They celebrate it. The Marine Corps' second engagement was the Second Seminole War, which raged from 1835 to 1842 in Florida, which was a foreign country at that time, Spanish territory. And they entered by water because they couldn't get across the border because of the Seminole resistance. It's the longest war in U.S. history until Vietnam.
You're listening to Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz on Native America, From Genocide to Resistance. This is Independent Alternative Radio. You can order copies of today's program by calling 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
The Second Seminole War during the Jackson administration had been identified with the extraordinary leaders of the Seminole resistance, Osceola. It was all-out war with the Army, Navy, and Marine Corps involved. Although they succeeded in killing Osceola, they lost the war as the Seminoles would not hand over the fugitive slaves among them, which is what all that was demanded of them. They said, you can have this swamp, you know. We don't care. Just give us all of the Africans among you. They did succeed in deporting captives, mostly women, children, and old men, to Indian Territory. But they didn't win. The U.S. Armed Forces tried again, 1855, the Third Seminole War, but after 4 years of siege, they lost again. So soon after that, the Civil War and the end of the institution of slavery made further war against the Seminoles unnecessary. That's marooning. You'll read, you know, historians who say there was no marooning slavery, and what's his name, Genovese, who said it was such a closed system, there was no resistance. That is ridiculous. It was armed resistance. And I left out the part about Texas, where the marooning along the Texas border, one of the reasons for the Mexican War was to prevent that refuge and move the border way down to the Rio Grande, because it was way up, you know, Colorado, Nebraska. While the U.S. Army invaded and occupied what is now California, Arizona, and New Mexico, the Marines invaded by sea and occupied Veracruz, using counterinsurgent tactics, along with the Texas Rangers, by the way, in their march to Mexico City, burning fields and villages, murdering and torturing civilian resistors. They occupied Mexico City along with army divisions until the Mexican government, with a gun at their head, signed a dubious treaty transferring the northern half of Mexico to the United States. In Marine Corps annals, the 1847 Battle of Chapultepec is legion, a battle in which a handful of teenage Mexican cadets, because the Chapultepec Castle was used for military training school, with very few weapons and little ammunition, held off the Marines, killing most of them over 2 days of endless fighting in the castle until the cadets themselves were all dead, and the remaining Marines raised the U.S. flag and wrote their hymn, tracing their genealogy to the invasion and occupation of Tripoli. The violence. We're going to have to really, I think, as socialists, try to take some leadership in this and think it through. I don't have the answers, you know, of course, but how do we deal with this? And when we look in the past, I know I've read some pacifists, this guy who writes all these books on different things, he wrote a book on nonviolence, Mark Kurleski, and I was really offended because he blamed the Native Americans themselves for taking up arms for what happened to them. And then he gives a false alternative, the Maori, implying that they didn't take up arms. How does he think they won the treaty that they still have? How do you think they survived? The counterinsurgency was formed by the violence against these peoples. There's nothing you can do when your whole family and community is violated and your crops, you have to somehow fight back. And then your refugees, you know, we never talk about Native refugees, which we know wars always produce refugees and civilians. Where are they? They're in dirty camps. And of course, the disease factor that's always used, people die of disease right now. Cholera is rampant in Syria among the refugees and, you know, just the civilian population. It's killing people. This is related to war. you know, don't believe this. Oh, they all drop dead when they see a European because they have no immunity. You know, that simply wasn't true. They were actually very long-lived people, longer, much longer than Europe, because they understood the concept of hygiene. I think you brought up a really important issue. The settler colonial state and capitalism, I left out my part about the capitalist state. The conclusion I've come to, the theory I've come to, I don't like to say conclusions because you have to keep thinking about these things, but is that the United States was the first entity founded as a capitalist state. And that's what's exceptional, is founded as a capitalist state. If you read through the Constitution, read through the Declaration, you find these indicators, you know, of the individualism. The first 10 amendments are individual rights, including the Second Amendment, by the way. It's an individual right to form a posse and kill Indians or round up slaves. In fact, every citizen's duty in slavery to turn in they see a black person, might be a freedman, ask for their papers, for their note from their master, whatever. I left that out, but it's very important. I gave the first examples of it, of the privatization of the warfare and the scalp, you know, the putting bounties, actually making a commodity, creating commodities of scalps. And most importantly, the slave's body was a commodity. This becomes more and more important with independence and the Cotton Kingdom, where capitalism really, the first industrial revolution really happened. They're made into capitalist commodities. And this is so important in so many ways to understand the effects of slavery and the mentality toward just, you know, white people still think of slave bodies as not free, as something to be owned or at least confined, because you look at the prisons. The founding of South Carolina, what became to be known as the Slave Coast, was extremely important because it was founded by Georgian already established slavers. And they moved into, that was Tuscarora Nation territory. They were very intense farmers. Farmers aren't warriors by nature. You have this warrior image, they're always fighters, that only really applies to some extent to the northern plains, really, of anywhere in North America, really only to the northern plains, but that even that is a flawed idea. But that's then put upon that these are all warriors, you know, ready to fight. No, they're farmers, like the Vietnamese, rice farmers. Farmers were sitting ducks, you know, dependent on the seasons, the crops, and the, you know, for life or death or starvation. And so that's what made the people vulnerable, you know, not disease. It's not the first thing people want to do, farmers, is arm themselves and, you know, and kill people. Unless they're plantation owners, you know. But if they're subsistent farmers, that, you know, that's ridiculous. So, and of course, they were collectively, they weren't individual farmers. It was collective. So breaking down the collective was essential. So if they wanted to become slave owners or property owners, that was fine for a while. Like I said, in the end, it wasn't fine with Andrew Jackson, because he hated all Indians of Indian heritage. In South Carolina, these very elite white plantation investors, I would just call them, you know, capitalist investors, the white people who came along, who were not necessarily, you know, just the people who could be recruited for slave patrols, smaller farmers or merchants or whatever, they were the militias. They were fighting the Tuscaroras, and they looked down on being, you know, chasing slaves for plantation owners. So that's when they put fines on them and everything. They couldn't get them to do it, so they actually formed and paid. This was the first police force. The very first, that goes right there to the late 17th century South Carolina, forming the very first paid professional police force, Slave Patrol. And then that became the model for, you know, the Cotton Kingdom and all later on of separate slave patrols. So the Tuscaroras, of course, knew that land, you know, after the Africans who were being brought in were new to this area. So they didn't know the terrain yet themselves to resist. So they ran away and they, you know, fought alongside and lived alongside the Tuscaroras. And then the Great Dismal Swamp became the maroon for the Tuscaroras and for the slaves. And it was huge, huge and long-lasting. The Tuscaroras eventually did a, you know, whole caravan in the South. They migrated north and asked to be under Six Nations, the Haudenosaunee protection. They actually self-relocated to upstate New York, where they, you know, generations have grown up since then. So they formed the sixth nation of the five nations of the Iroquois. The others were all formed before the Europeans came. Back to the military and, of course, the Marines is, I think you all know by now probably that the term of the trade for enemy territory and the jargon of all the services, but especially the Army and the Marines, is Indian country. Not to speak of all the war machinery that's named after, like trophies, Cherokee and Seminole and Black Hawks, and of course the Redskins and all that. So this fetishism, I call it, you know, a fetishism. It's like body part trophies, like in Vietnam, the soldiers were sending back fingers, eyes, you know, of those they had killed. These are war trophies in a, you know, an illegal and unjust, if there's any just war. I mean, resistance is just. So Indian country's enemy territory. I argue historians who don't want this to be true and others want to tell me I have to prove it, but I don't have to prove it. They have to prove it's wrong. is when they say in country, they're abbreviating Indian country. So you hear Rachel Maddow, oh, in country, you're in country. They're saying enemy territory. You'll hear that now more often because they have been schooled, the military. They still use it among themselves, but not to do like in the first Gulf War and have, you know, Colin Powell openly saying, well, when we enter Indian country, we'll have a battle on our hands, you know. And this brought the attention to the American Indian organizations that protested, saying, unfortunately, there were Native people fighting over there, but not really giving the history, you know. And so, in fact, the very first casualty in the first Gulf War was a Hopi woman soldier. And that's a whole thing of war and patriotism and Native nations today, the whole colonized mentality. The class system. I wanted to make a point about this class system that developed. If capitalism through colonialism comes in any place, they impose capitalism. So there's always some, you know, they call them compradores in Africa. They call them caciques in the Spanish Empire. They just call them, I don't know what. They set up schools like Dartmouth and all to have an elite class especially among the Six Nations, the Haudenosaunee, to collaborate with them. But what's remarkable and really important to remember, and it also is important to remember, you read Cedric Robinson, of Africans bringing cultural forms with them, and this has persisted. It's not so easy to kill a culture that's collective. Maybe that's the only kind of real social relations that it's the normal social relations for human beings. And capitalism is such a distortion, really, of human nature, you know, the socialization, the requirement of collectivity to survive, because we're these naked little hairless, vulnerable creatures. Guns have sort of replaced collectivity. In all of these cases, I don't know of a single Native nation, including the Cherokee, which is the most compromised, that there's not still the vestiges of collectivity. So the Christianity, I think, you know, I grew up raised a Southern Baptist in rural Oklahoma. I have a lot of insights that many people on the left don't have, because I was devout. I didn't question anything until I was 18 years old. One of the songs we sang was, "Are you washed in the blood of the Lamb? Are your garments spotless? Are they white as snow? Are they washed in the blood?" So we know blood is not white, but it's cleansing through blood. You know, and this goes back to the Crusades. I make that point that yes, there is a using the terminology and the memes of Indian warfare among Muslims, but it's also the Crusades against the Muslims. Back then, you know, I mean, Spain was Muslim, or Iberian Peninsula was Muslim. That four centuries of driving out what they call the Moors and the Jews and deporting, the day Columbus passed through Seville Harbor, they were loading the ships with Jews, 1492. Then the Moors were deported. Most North Africans are descended, you know, many are descended from those people. And so this went on for centuries, you know. So Muslims aren't a new enemy. There's that arc that they actually brought a lot of those methods of counterinsurgency against Muslims into the colonization projects of Europe, which just, you know, followed the minute they cleansed Spain in 1492, they're off to overseas colonization. They had already established the transatlantic slave trade with the papal bull of 1494 that gave Portugal, what was then a Portuguese monarch, ownership of West Africa and all the people in it. So, the privatization, I mentioned that, you know, that early privatization with scalp hunting. There's always been mercenaries that accompanied U.S. military forces. Most of the ones fighting the Sandinistas in the southern front in Costa Rica were mercenaries from previous wars. When they were doing the Contra War, they recruited Vietnam veterans. They went around the country recruiting Vietnam combat veterans to serve as mercenaries, not as active participants, because that was a covert war that was not very secret. So that's always been the case. And of course, I mentioned the slave patrols being paid. They were mercenaries. Police forces are really descendants of mercenary outfits themselves. So I think to distinguish between the black water and, you know, tiger swan and the regular military is kind of, it makes it sound like the regular military is better. You know what I mean? So it's always been a part of the package. It's to be expected. Well, Santa Fe, of course, I did my very first book, my dissertation, my very first book on the history of land tenure in New Mexico. So I actually studied Spanish colonialism before I studied Anglo colonialism. And you get to that in New Mexico. It has these layers of colonialism, two Spanish colonialisms, because there was the Pueblo Revolt in 1680. So you have two different, so you have two celebrations, the conquered Oñate, and then the Reentrada, as it's called, of de Vargas after the Pueblo Revolt. So there are constant celebrations of colonialism in Santa Fe. It's really disgusting. So, you know, it does create a lot of issues, because when that territory is taken from Mexico, it's very different, you know, as people have lived under Spanish colonialism, the Pueblos. There were 98 city-states in the beginning, and the Spanish reduced it to 21. and now it's 19, and the Hopi are included in that, Arizona, New Mexico. So they, you know, they didn't have treaties. They had a very different relationship with the colonizer, just as brutal, just as genocidal, just as bad. But they were more like a proletariat. They were worked, you know, in slave-like labor in factories. They cotton is indigenous to New Mexico. So big cotton producer and making what they call mantas, these shirts, to sell throughout the empire, you know, and back in Spain. So it was a big proletarianization of the Pueblo Indians. So it's, you know, it's just a very, very different system. So it's, you can't have just one, you have those layers of colonialism, and that'll take me to genocide in California. You know, California was colonized by the Spanish up to San Francisco. The first European border in North America was Russia and Spain, right above San Francisco, at a place called Fort Ross, which is Russian. The Russians only colonized along the coast. But it was mainly a trade relationship with the coastal people. So they were not really affected by colonialism until the Americans came in 1848. And it was catastrophic because, it was private and military. Some of the biggest generals, Canby, they killed him. He was a general in the Union Army. He was the main person in charge of the MODOCs, which is one of the, you know, the whole MODOC war was really a siege and a genocide. And the MODOCs actually killed him. So the reprisals were horrible. But again, these were farming and fishing people who lived very bountiful lives up in that area, were still just practicing their traditional cultures. They had definitely had cultural relationships. So they had the Rainbow Bridge. They had made journeys to Hawaii, you know, in pre-colonial times. And their oral tradition, that's very clear. They had incredible medicines. So yes, it was a genocide, but it was different in terms of in the way that the Holocaust is unique of being compressed in time. You know, the Genocide Convention that came after the Holocaust didn't require that compressed time because it was a prevention of genocide convention. And so what it looked at was all the pogroms that went on in Europe and the Crusades and all that led up to the genocide, the compressed genocide. So all of that pre-genocide in slower motion led up to this absolutely compressed within a few years of total genocide. So that's the way it's the same, it's related, you know, it can't be separated. The Genocide Convention is very specific. There's no such thing as this is the genocide of indigenous peoples, you know, and of course there were nations and peoples. So there's so many different situations, but to finally have a clear picture of this history, which regular historians aren't going to do, at least not with, you know, with an understanding of colonialism, is to develop those case studies. So that's what is really also useful. But it is also unique. It's actually more like, you know, the Holocaust, which is not what the Genocide Convention requires. Removing children from the family, the boarding schools, genocide. But see, it's not shooting people or putting them in gas ovens, but it's removing people. Anything that breaks down the collective nature so those people can no longer be a people, but maybe they're staggered in individuals. And if that's the intent, even if it's not successful, then that's genocide. Well, thank you very much.
That was Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz on Native America, From Genocide to Resistance. She spoke at the International Socialist Organization's annual conference in Chicago. Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, scholar and award-winning author, has been active in the international indigenous movement for more than four decades and is known for her commitment to social justice issues. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and part of the nonprofit media education organization, Rise Up. We are supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature progressive voices rarely heard in the media, such as Richard Wolff, Winona LaDuke, Noam Chomsky, Vandana Shiva, Michael Eric Dyson, and Angela Davis. And we have other Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz programs. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.